Hello and welcome to A Killer Podcast.
We're a true crime podcast created by lifelong best friends who share a birthday, a shoe size, and a borderline unhealthy obsession with true crime.
I'm Freya Millard.
And I'm Amy Woodcock, and we're your hosts.
On each new season of A Killer Podcast, we explore a different theme surrounding true crime. And to kick it all off in season one, we investigated murders with a supernatural twist.
That's right. And for season two, we are tackling cases surrounding murder for money. So we'll be talking about the most extravagant and crazy ways people try to kill each other for some extra cash.
And don't forget, we've also got our two-part Halloween special out right now, and we have plans for many more specials in the works.
At the end of each episode, we try to give you a glance at the bigger picture of the true crime field by asking each other burning questions relating to our educational backgrounds.
Yes, you see, I have a social science background, and Amy has one in forensics, and between the both of us, we hope to paint a relatively thorough picture.
So what are you waiting for? Get listening on your preferred podcasting platform at A Killer Podcast.
And feel free to follow along with us on social media at A Killer Podcast.
Until then, have a killer week.
Goodbye!
I'm your host, Paige, and you're listening to Reverie True Crime, the Halloween special. All of these murders took place on Halloween. Let's jump right into it. Halloween night, 2011, at 7150 South Winchester Avenue in Chicago, Illinois. Liddell Peoples was 55 years old at the time when he and his friend Maria Adams, who was 49, got into a heated argument on Halloween. Maria didn't live with Liddell. She resided on the 8200 block of South May Street, but she was just hanging out with him on Halloween. That afternoon, Liddell was irate over a missing bag of candy. He accused Maria of taking the candy. This confrontation got so out of hand, and Liddell was so enraged over this candy, more than a child would even be, that things turned violent quickly. Maria was terrified and began to throw plates at Liddell to defend herself. One of the plates struck Liddell over his eye, cutting him above his eyebrow. This pushed Liddell over the edge. He grabbed several steak knives and started to stab Maria. Afterwards, Liddell called the cops and told them what happened. He was arrested and held in Cook County Jail with a bond of $2 million. Maria was rushed to the hospital. While Maria was in critical condition, Liddell was charged with attempted first-degree murder and aggravated domestic battery. Unfortunately, a few days later, on November 5th, Maria passed away from the multiple injuries. Liddell Peoples was convicted of the murder of Maria and sentenced to 30 years in prison. This next event takes place in Pasadena, Texas, the 31st of October, 1974. It was Halloween night, and 30-year-old Ronald O'Brien, an optician in Houston, took his two children, Timothy, who was 8, and his 5-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, out to do the traditional trick-or-treating as most parents do. He even allowed their friends to tag along to join in on the fun. The kids went to one home, and no one came to the door. Assuming no one was home, the kids ran to another house, excited to get as much candy as they could. The O'Brien's family's neighbor, Jim Bates, was with them that night. He also figured no one was at home, and he tagged along with the kids. Ronald O'Brien didn't follow them. Instead, he just stayed behind, sticking around the house that everyone suspected to be empty. He was standing on the home's front porch. Ronald eventually got back to their group, showing off 5 big 24-inch-long pixie sticks. If anyone listening may not know what pixie sticks are, it's a candy straw-looking stick and each with different flavors of powder in it. And Ronald told Jim Bates, quote, "You must have some rich neighbors, Jim," end quote. as he handed each child a pixie stick. Ronald told the group that while they were ahead of him, the person at the home that they thought no one was in came to the door and gave him the candy. It started drizzling rain, so the kids only trick-or-treated for around 30 minutes before they all had to go home due to the weather. Ronald, Timothy, and Elizabeth got settled in at home. Ronald was about to go to bed, but before doing so, he told Timothy and Elizabeth that they could only have one piece of candy before they went to bed. They decided to choose the huge pixie sticks. When little Timothy was pouring the candy in his mouth, he realized something wasn't right. This pixie stick didn't have a sweet flavor. Timothy grimaced and told his dad, quote, "This tastes really bitter," end quote. Ronald fixed Timothy a glass of Kool-Aid to get the taste out of his son's mouth, but immediately Timothy yelled, quote, "Daddy, Daddy, my stomach hurts," end quote. Timothy was in the bathroom with horrible stomach pain. He was convulsing, vomiting, and gasping for air. Ronald called 911, and very quickly an ambulance was at their house. The paramedics got Timothy as fast as they could into the ambulance, but, unfortunately, it was too late. It was 10:30 p.m. on Halloween night, 1974, when your typical, happy-go-lucky, energetic, 8-year-old third grader, Timothy Mark O'Brien, was reportedly pronounced dead on arrival at Southmore General Hospital in Pasadena, Texas. It was reported that he did pass away while in the ambulance. The following day, it was discovered that the pixie sticks had a lot of cyanide blended into it. Elizabeth, however, still had the unopened pixie stick held in her hand the following morning in her sleep. She wasn't able to get it open because it was sealed securely with staples. That pixie stick also had cyanide mixed in. Cyanide is a majorly toxic, destructive white crystalline solid with the smallest smell, like bitter almonds. Potassium cyanide's venomousness emanates from its capability to hinder a person's respiration. It malnourishes the body of oxygen. Even in the smallest amounts, potassium cyanide can cause someone to nearly die on the spot. And this is precisely what happened to Timothy. Ronald cried loudly and told reporters, quote, 30 seconds after I left Tim's room, I heard him cry to me, "Daddy, Daddy, my stomach hurts." He was in the bathroom convulsing, gasping, and vomiting, and then suddenly he went limp, end quote. Ronald even gave a moving, quite demonstrative eulogy at Timothy's funeral. The residence where he alleged to obtain the pixie sticks was blanketed in suspicions. Elizabeth Bagwell, who lives in the O'Brien residence now, said, quote, "Someone took it upon themselves to take away the trust and fun away from a lot of parents and a lot of children," end quote. The news spread like wildfire that a little child had died due to cyanide in his candy. Not only was it all over the media in Texas, but the news was traveling all across the United States. Talking to the Associated Press, a detective who was working on the case stated that every parent should throw away every single bit of their children's Halloween candy. The detective said, quote, "It's just not worth the risk. If parents want their children to eat candy, let them go to the store and buy candy," end quote. Parents from all over started to get rid of all of the candy their kids had collected on Halloween night. This is why, to this day, parents check their kids' candy to see if it's been tampered with. Ronald even helped the authorities to try to find the house where the pixie sticks were given out. During this investigation, the kids who went trick-or-treating with Ronald, Timothy, and Elizabeth that night all together had 5 pixie sticks that were filled with cyanide. Ronald volunteering to help the police was really suspicious to them. They were trick-or-treating in such a small location that night, but he couldn't remember which houses they went to. Finally, Ronald remembered that the address of the home he received the pixie sticks was at 4112 Dunrell Avenue in Pasadena, Texas. Ronald told the authorities that he didn't get a good look at the man who gave him the candy, but he said that he had a hairy arm. The authorities discovered pretty fast that 45-year-old Courtney Melvin, an air traffic controller at Hobby Airport, lived at that address. Courtney did not have a criminal record. He was married and a dad. Even though he didn't seem at all like the type to give children candy filled with cyanide, they took him in for questioning anyway. They asked him where he was that night. Courtney told them that he was at his job on the night of the 31st, saying that he wasn't even home until 11 that night. That was a long time after the O'Briens and everyone with them had finished their trick-or-treating outing. 200-some-odd co-workers of Courtney Melvin's verified that he was at work, and police let him go and he was not a suspect. Quickly, something was found out. Ronald had not long ago taken out a few life insurance policies on Timothy and Elizabeth. Timothy was insured for $30,000. November 4th, Ronald O'Brien was apprehended for the murder of Timothy. The authorities kept their evidence close to the vest. Fast forward a week. It turns out, during the grand jury hearing, there was no doubt that this father was guilty of killing his own son. Ronald phoned one of his chemist friends 2 months before Timothy's death. He asked this chemist how much cyanide was a lethal amount and how could he get some. For some reason, the chemist didn't realize that these questions were a huge red flag. All he did was ask Ronald why he was asking. Ronald told him it was just out of curiosity, that's all. It was brought to everyone's attention by a chemical salesman who took the stand that Ronald attempted to buy potassium cyanide, but he couldn't because the only size they had was 5 pounds. Ronald concluded that was too much and too obvious, so he decided not to forego the purchase. The parents of the children that went trick-or-treating that night with the O'Brien family recalled that Ronald went to one house by himself and they saw him come back with pixie sticks that he then gave to his 2 children, the family that went with them, their 2 children, and another child that lived in the area. Since he tried to poison all of these children, Ronald was charged with 4 counts of attempted murder. Ronald's brother took the stand and told the courtroom that Ronald, quote, was a poor manager who had trouble keeping a job and was in poor financial condition at the time of Timothy's death, end quote. The trial occurred in May of 1975. Witnesses, as well as his wife, all testified against Ronald. His wife, Danine, said that living with Ronald and their marriage was boring, that they continuously struggled with drowning in debt and financial pressures. Danine said that they were behind on a few loans that they needed to pay back, but Ronald bought $10,000 of accidental life insurance for Timothy and Elizabeth. It was only after Timothy's funeral that Danine found out. Ronald spent another $108 on premiums for 2 extra policies that were $20,000 apiece. After Timothy passed away, she was shocked because Ronald was casually talking about how they were going to spend the money to pay off bills and go on a vacation to Florida. During the trial, she testified against her husband, which could have sent him to the electric chair. She seemed cool, calm, and collected without showing really any emotion at all. She said what she had to say, and she wouldn't look at Ronald. Ronald's insurance agent took the stand to say that Ronald had indeed called him within hours of Timothy dying to get the ball rolling to file the claim. The defense's witnesses were called to testify. They all spoke of Ronald in the highest regards. They said how sweet he was, that he was nice to children, and he always went to church. One of Ronald's co-workers testified, quote, "He was a very concerned parent, very sensitive to their needs," end quote. Ronald's lawyer attempted to save him from a lot of the prosecution's claims that were extremely damaging to Ronald's case. It was time for the closing arguments, and the attorney stated that the prosecution didn't have any substantial proof that Ronald bought the cyanide. That was not enough for the jury because on June 3rd of 1975, they determined Ronald was guilty. The jury only deliberated for 46 minutes before coming to their decision. On June 4th, the former backup cop, optician, and soon-to-be Danine's ex-husband was sentenced to die in the electric chair. When it was Ronald's time to be electrocuted, it was March 31st of 1984, and the method had been changed to lethal injection. Ronald breathed his last breath at 12:48 in the morning by lethal injection, and he stood firm that he was not guilty until he died. Beforehand, he even did an interview in which he said, quote, "Because I have no guilt, I really got nothing to worry about," end quote. Well, he was definitely wrong, and this was Ronald O'Brien's final statement. Quote, "What is about to transpire in a few moments is wrong. However, we as humans do make mistakes and errors. This execution is one of those wrongs, yet doesn't mean our whole system of justice is wrong. Therefore, I would forgive all who have taken part in any way in my death. Also, to anyone I have offended in any way during my 39 years, I pray and ask for your forgiveness, just as I forgive anyone who offended me in any way. And I pray and ask God's forgiveness for all of us respectively as human beings. To my loved ones, I extend my undying love. To those close to me, know in your hearts I love you one and all. God bless you all. And may God's best blessings be always yours. Ronald C. O'Brien. P.S. During my time here, I have been treated very well by all TDC personnel." End quote. While waiting outside of the Texas prison, around 300 people were standing outside of the death chamber. People that worked at a local bar handed out pixie sticks to all of them as they celebrated. Ronald is known as the man who ruined Halloween, the man who killed Halloween, and the Candyman. He is said to be buried at the Forest Park East Cemetery. Policeman Bill Lanier said in 2003, quote, "He was a wolf in sheep's clothing. Every Halloween I think about him. He's a despicable man and his whole life was a lie." End quote. ExecutedToday.com states, "Susie and the Banshees turned this creeper scenario to good effect in 1986 with their song, Candyman." This final story comes out of Kalamazoo, Michigan, Halloween 2012. 55-year-old John Douglas White used to be a minister in Michigan. His fiancée's 24-year-old daughter, Rebecca Gay, who was also a loving mother to her little boy Conway, was missing. John prayed to God with his church that she would be found. However, he knew exactly where she was and what happened to her. John might have been a preacher, but he was a former convict as well. On Halloween night, 2012, he did the unthinkable. He murdered Rebecca because he had dark fantasies of necrophilia. John had a few beers and went to her trailer. He began beating her on the head with a mallet and choked her to death with a large zip tie. As he was striking her over the head with the mallet, he stated that he heard her say, quote, "I know you," end quote. When she was dead, he took her clothes off and he touched her. However, he couldn't recall if he had sex with her corpse or not. He does remember trying to get an erection, but he couldn't get it up. Right after John went and dumped Rebecca's body, he went back to the trailer to get her 3-year-old Conway and dress him in his costume to go trick-or-treating. He went to Conway's dad's home and dropped him off. He eventually couldn't take it, and he confessed it all that day when he was told that Rebecca's body was likely to basically fade away and start to deteriorate in the cold, wet weather. Police had located Rebecca's body in a large ditch, hidden behind really tall pine trees. This place was only a mile from Rebecca's house. When he confessed, he told the police that his desires were driven by necrophilia porn videos. John confessed that he dreamed about killing Rebecca for about 2 weeks before strolling into her trailer around 2 a.m. on October 31st. And this is according to the affidavit filed in Isabella County Trial Court by County Sheriff's Detective Sergeant David Patterson. Isabella County Sheriff told the Associated Press, quote, "He kept saying he's a bad person. He's a pastor. He felt bad for the people in his church. I don't recall him being real remorseful at all with regard to the victim or anything else. He just basically said he was attracted to her, thought she was a very cute girl. It's a crazy, tragic situation," end quote. John had a criminal past and repented for his sins. He was such a religious man, and the members of the church that he preached at just couldn't understand how John could just go back to such a dark place. John told authorities that he loaded Rebecca's body, the bloody towels he used to clean up her blood, as well as the mallet, into one big garbage bag. According to the court records, John said he put the bag into the back of his truck, but he said it ripped and the contents spilled out. John told cops that he threw Rebecca's purse, phone, and car keys in the trailer park garbage bin and got rid of all the other items at the intersection where Rebecca's body was eventually discovered. According to the affidavit, he told police that he drove Rebecca's car to a bar close by called the Barn Door. He parked her car in the bar's parking lot to make it look like she had been kidnapped. The Michigan State Police Crime Lab discovered blood in both Rebecca's and John's mobile homes. They also found blood and a necklace in the back of John's pickup truck, according to a detective. The way Rebecca was killed was just like Vicky Sue Wall's brutal murder that John also committed in 1994. Vicky was a 26-year-old Comstock Township woman who went missing in July of 1994. John was detained in relation with Vicky's passing, and first he was charged with murder. He later claimed he was guilty of involuntary manslaughter and was sent to prison to serve only 8 to 15 years. Vicky's severely decaying body was retrieved in September of 1994. In the woods in the 7400 block of East H Avenue. Kalamazoo County Sheriff's investigators later apprehended John White, and he was charged with the murder of Vicky Wall. John admitted to choking her and that he abandoned her body on Gull Road. During this time, investigators viewed the security cameras at the store that John went to prior to the killing. It showed Vicky getting into John's truck on July 11, 1994. Cops suspected during this time John White, a married man, father of two, and a baby on the way, murdered Vicky because she was insisting that John leave his wife for her. The two encountered each other at work. They worked together at a business in Oshtemo Township. After he met up with Vicky at the store, he voluntarily went to the Kalamazoo Regional Psychiatric Hospital and checked himself in. John was arrested while he was in the hospital in September of 1994, a week after the authorities found Vicky's nude body with only a bra and shirt around her neck. Vicky's body had basically rotted to the point that they couldn't determine the cause of her death. John's sentencing was in May of 1995. During the trial, he said her death, quote, was a tragic accident, and I loved Vicky, end quote. John was also sentenced to probation in 1981 for strangling and stabbing a 17-year-old female named Teresa Morris. He stabbed this poor girl 15 times in 1980. He did this in the basement of his house in Calhoun County. He was charged with battery with intent to do extreme bodily damage for the stabbing. He pleaded no contest. Teresa told the cops as he was stabbing her, he said, quote, "You're going to go now. I'm really sorry you had to go like this, but what the fuck? You're just a woman," end quote. Of Rebecca's killing and regarding Rebecca's son, Teresa said, quote, "I really hurt for that little boy. I really hurt for her family. They trusted him, so I know exactly what they're going through," end quote. For Teresa's severe assault, he only served 2 years. John appealed and won because his lawyer did not raise an insanity defense. When he was out of prison, John received 2 years of probation, and he was made to have mental health treatment. Teresa didn't know that John was released from prison. One day, she was standing in line somewhere, and she heard a familiar voice. She saw him, and he smiled at her. Teresa said she is so disappointed in the system. So, after all of this, he supposedly found God and dedicated all of his time in church and became a pastor. Going back to Rebecca's murder, a 76-year-old lady by the name of Donna that was a member of the church stated that John was engaged to Rebecca's mother, Sally Gay, and would watch Rebecca's little boy while she was at her job. The elder lady that said this was the one who helped get John hired as the pastor of the Christ Community Fellowship Church. All of the church members were in disbelief and in a state of shock. The lady said, quote, "I protested his innocence until I had the absolute news that he confessed. Then he had no leg to stand on," end quote. Donna also said, quote, "He was absolutely contrite. All kinds of people turn around and meet the Lord and they are a different person. He was doing a lot of good in the community. He was doing a lot of good, and Satan didn't want him doing good, and Satan got to him," end quote. The week before he killed Rebecca, he was just cleaning Donna's gutters out for her, which led him to his Sunday talk when he said, quote, "We need to check closely the seeds we sprout in ourselves. Nothing can be hidden from God," end quote. Matt Brown, who resided in the trailer park, said that John went to Rebecca's on a regular basis. The night that Rebecca had gone missing, he went around telling everyone that he couldn't find her, and he had a lot of scratches on his face, Matt recalls. Matt said, quote, "It looked like he was in a struggle," end quote. John White was to spend the maximum sentence allowed under a plea agreement, which was 56 years and 3 months in jail. After only spending 4 months in prison, on the 28th of August 2013, he hung himself in his cell, and this was sometime shortly after 4 in the morning. Prison officials made an effort to save him, but it was far too late. John died at 56 years old, and the only thing he left following his death was just a legacy of loathing and viciousness to females. John's son, Gabriel, summed up his father's life in the most suitable way when he said, quote, he was completely crazy until the end, end quote. That does it for this episode of Murders That Happened on Halloween. If you'd like more stories, you can join the Patreon for $3 a month for exclusives, snail mail, and more at patreon.com/reverietruecrime. You can opt out anytime, there's no pressure to stay, and if you sign up now, you won't have to pay November or December because I'm pausing payments for the holidays. Every dollar counts during those times. Just a side note, if you do sign up in November, Patreon will charge you the $3, but you won't have to pay in December. Thank you to Lorraine, Melissa, Trevor, Liz, Shayla, Madeline, Maggie, Kara, Emily, and Denise for hanging out on the Patreon. Your support definitely means so much to me, and I'm grateful for all of you. Until next time, stay safe and stay healthy. I love ya.